You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 12th, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Actually, we have a lot of content in this show, so we're going to sort of cut the opening banter and get right to our news items. It's a lot of follow-up this episode. And we're going to start with you, Bob, who's going to tell us about the theory of everything. That's a popular topic with cranks.
Interesting article this week on Life Science describing the theory of everything and that it could take millennia to actually discover what it is, if it even exists at all. So this is an article. The title was Einstein's Quest to Know God's Thoughts. Could take millennia. That's the title. This is by Don Lincoln, who's a senior scientist at Fermilab, National Accelerator Laboratory. So you guys have heard the theory of everything, right? I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
Especially since I've probably mentioned it a bunch of times on the show. And I'm not referring to the movie about Stephen Hawking. It's kind of, you know, frustrating. I'm like trying to Google theory of everything and everything that came up was the movie. Like, no. So it's simply called TOE. T-O-E, and I'm not sure if that is an acronym or an initialism. I'm going to assume it's an acronym and pronounce it TOE. So one way to look at TOE is it's basically an anticipated future theory that's as all-encompassing as it is simple. One single theory, a single particle, a single force. With that and enough smarts, you should be able to probably predict or derive or just simply explain essentially every type of phenomenon we can see or infer within the universe. So I've been hearing about this for literally decades, waiting for some major breakthroughs. And this is, if Don is correct, I'm going to have a longer wait than I anticipated.
So to clarify, Bob, my understanding of the theory of everything is that it's a deeper theory than any we currently have.
Absolutely.
There's something that underlies reality. It's like I could explain all of reality with crayon theory. It's all being created by crayons or whatever. So would you say that like string theory is a theory of everything? Does that even qualify? Like we could explain all particles, all forces, all interactions as vibrating strings in multiple dimensions, or would that not even be deep enough?
That's damn close. I would think that's where you start getting far beyond what we could do today, what we have today in terms of our best explanatory models. And so we do have two. There are two explanatory models. Or I'll call them our apex theories, if you will. General relativity and the standard model is another way to look at it. So general relativity, as we've said many, many times, that describes gravity and the universe at the biggest scales, galaxies, clusters, and such. The standard model describes a small scale universe, 16 particles and forces, quarks, gluons, leptons, etc. So these theories can be used basically as a recipe to recreate all the matter that we know about, incredibly impressive theory, amazing, but still a far, far cry from being a TOE, a theory of everything. So why is that? And you guys may have heard of GUTS, Grand Unified Theory.
Uh-huh.
That's another one. And for a while there, I was like, I really wanted to take a deeper dive on both of these. What's the difference between GUTS and a TOE? And essentially, a gut is not a TOE. Basically, guts are, or a grand unified theory, is a unification of the fundamental subatomic forces in nature. So electromagnetism, the weak force, and the strong force. So we've already shown that electromagnetism, which is a unification of the electric and magnetic force, right? I mean, you tend to, you kind of miss that. You think, oh, electromagnetism, light, but it really was a major breakthrough unifying or discovering that electromagnetism was an electric and magnetic force together, combined, a unification of those two. But they've also combined the weak force with electromagnetism in the 60s to create the electroweak force. So now, besides gravity, there's two fundamental forces, and you've got the electroweak and the strong force. So gut models theorize that at even more grand energies, there will be a low energy manifestation of a single force, a combination of the electroweak force and the strong force, what's being called the electronuclear force. So that's the grand unified theory. It's a tiny prerequisite unification that a theory of everything would require. It may be grand, but it's not nearly as grand as a theory of everything. So the question becomes, okay, we've got 12 particles and four forces that are described by the standard model. So how do we distill that down to one particle and one force? It's obviously not going to be an easy task. But one of the things we have to do that's important is that we've got to add something that's not even in the standard model, things like dark matter, dark energy, and gravity. They aren't even part of it. The standard model doesn't even address that. So you've got to add that on top of that massively complex model that's a standard model. So what we need to do is we need more unifications to get to a theory of everything. That's kind of the bottom line. We've done some amazing unifications already, but we need more of these unifications in order to get there. So I mentioned the grand unified theory just a moment ago. We've got to take that theory essentially and then combine that with the unification of relativity and quantum mechanics or quantum gravity. That's one of the huge unifications that ultimately hopefully we will do, but it's going to be needed before we can get to a theory of everything. And then on top of all that, don't forget, we need to throw in dark energy. And how does that fit? And once we unify dark energy, if we ever do with these other unifications, what is that going to do to change things? Who knows what directions this is going to go to? So essentially what we need to do is unify quantum gravity and GUT, grand unified theory. But to do that, we're going to need a bigger boat. I mean, a bigger collider, of course, and a lot bigger. It's going to be so gargantuanly huge that it's essentially incomprehensible. So we would need a particle accelerator that operates at the Planck energy realm, and the Planck length scale. So that's like 10 to the minus 32 centimeters. Such an accelerator would concentrate enough energy in such a small scale that quantum gravitational effects can be observed, which is what we would need to create a theory of everything. So, I mean, 10, a quadrillion times more energy than we have now. So that is one of the reasons why Don was saying that this is going to take millennia, because that, I mean, what's it going to take to actually create that kind of energy and concentrate it in such a small space?
All right. So that was the reason for his prediction. He's not really predicting the pace of scientific discovery. He's saying the technological challenge of creating a collider with this energy is we're just nowhere near it. You know, it's going
right.
to take.
I mean, yeah, we're talking energy that even Q from Trek would be intimidated by. It's like, think about it. Yeah, let's make a quadrillion times more energy than we do now. It's just something that's so far in the future. So there's lots of speculation involved here because there's so many unknowns, and who knows what dark energy is going to do once we can kind of fold that into our attempt to achieve the theory of everything. So my ultimate guess is that humans aren't going to do it. It's going to be accomplished by either an AI or a greatly augmented human intelligence in order to do this. If we can't harness those energies, and who knows, how long it would take before we can harness something like energies a quadrillion times more than we can now. Perhaps an artificial intelligence can kind of infer or kind of theorize what lays down at this basement level of the universe instead in terms of particle physics. In that sense, if I'm correct, it could be something that could take perhaps, 100 years or 80 years before an AI is like, oh, I know what this is. I know how this works. But otherwise, if we don't develop an AI or augment our minds, it's going to take a while. So just sit back, and I'll end with a quote from the article that I really liked. The notion that a genius will have an insight that results in a fully developed theory of everything in the next few years is a myth. We're in for a long slog, and even the grandchildren of today's scientists won't see the end of it, but what a journey it will be. So yeah, it's all about the journey, people. We have no choice.
So one question I have is, do we absolutely need to have a theory of everything? Maybe it doesn't exist. Just because we've been able to unify some forces, does that necessarily mean we could extrapolate that to say that all forces are ultimately unified? Maybe there's more than one fundamental force.
No, it does not absolutely mean that at all. I mean, it could be this, and this is the scary thing. It could mean that there is, an infinite number of layers. Some people actually believe that, but I don't think that there's an infinite regression there, because then the energy scales would be noticeable, and mm-hmm. it would be too large.
Okay, thanks, Bob. All right, Evan. Going to go from physics to something a little bit pseudoscientific. The FBI, has Bigfoot documents.
Oh, they have Bigfoot documents. And not just Bigfoot documents from the 1970s. Yeah. All right, let me set this up for you because I got to paint the picture a little, and then we'll get
into
the story.
Are they funky?
Oh gosh, are they funky? We remember the 70s. Funky. All right, the rise of Bigfoot lore in the 1970s. Oh my gosh, it was huge. It took off, and it hasn't ceased. I did a little research. Oh my gosh, some of these movies and documentaries in the 1970s about Bigfoot, just amazing. The Legend of Boggy Creek, based on a Bigfoot who terrorized a town in Arkansas. Or this one, Mysterious Monsters, Bigfoot, which answers tough questions like, what are Sasquatch's breasts like? No, that is from a Bigfoot documentary in 1975. I kid you not, that is real. And there's just too many other examples. Oh, how about this? If you don't think it's so pervasive in our culture and so saturated in our culture, how about this movie that came out last year? The Man Who Killed Hitler and Then Killed Bigfoot. Yes, that was a movie from 2018. Mm-hmm. So you can't escape it. And that we can't escape it, well, it made the headlines again this week when the FBI released 22 pages of its investigation into Bigfoot from the 1970s. So here's what happened. In 1976, a prominent Bigfoot researcher, his name's Peter Byrne, he's the director of the Bigfoot Information Center and Exhibition. And he wrote to the FBI asking if they would agree to analyze some hairs and a little bit of skin that they had picked up in the woods, and they said it was of an unknown origin. So in response to that request, Byrne received a letter dated December 15, 1976, from Jay Cochran, Jr., Assistant Director of the agency's Scientific and Technical Services Division. He wrote, "The FBI laboratory conducts investigations primarily of physical evidence for law enforcement agencies in connection with criminal investigations. Occasionally, on a case-by-case basis, in the interest of research and scientific inquiry, we make exceptions to this policy. With this understanding, we will examine the hairs and tissue mentioned in your letter." Now, before we get to what the studies by the FBI revealed, I will tell you this. There is evidence that Peter Byrne's group first wrote the FBI about this, and they wrote several letters to the FBI about it, because there was a prank played by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. The engineers used to publish local atlases that detailed America's flora and fauna. The 1975 edition of the Pacific Northwest included a reference to Sasquatch, complete with a map of possible sightings and cryptic references to the FBI. For example, this was in the atlas. Alleged Sasquatch hair samples inspected by FBI laboratories resulted in the conclusion that no such hair exists on any human or presently known animal for which such data is available. They actually put that in the atlas. Well, people went nuts. It caused a flurry of news stories, and a bunch of people wrote the FBI demanding that they release the results of the cryptid hair test, which never really existed in the first place. It was just a joke that caught fire, you know, because, hey, it's the 70s and Bigfoot's big deal, and there you go. So that's what you get, government, when you start messing around with people's beliefs. In any case, the FBI wound up examining the tissue and the hair. And they wrote him back. They wrote Byrne back in February 24th, 1977. Here's what they said. "The hairs which you recently delivered to the FBI laboratory on behalf of your organization have been examined by transmitted and incident light microscopy. It was concluded as a result of these examinations that the hairs are of deer family origin. The hair sample you submitted is being returned as an enclosure, as is an enclosure to this letter." So they sent the hair back too. I mean, that's kind of funny. What a shock. It turned out to be deer hair. Well, so if you read the headlines of the stories this week, and tell me a news organization that didn't pick up this story and ran with it. Everybody ran with it. Your FBI releases files on Bigfoot and investigation into Bigfoot finally released. They really kind of tried to sell it to people. Is this a Bigfoot investigation? I mean, some people sent in some hair and they got a letter back. I mean, is that really an investigation per se? I think it's a bunch of, you know, overhyped nonsense, frankly. And who knows why? I guess for Freedom of Information Act rules, they had to disclose this particular letter. I guess it became of age and there it was out there. If anybody requests it, they're allowed to get it after a certain amount of years have passed. But seriously, this is just, you know, kind of silly. And the fact that Everybody picked up this story. Every news outlet ran with it. Well, I think it just goes to show you how saturated our culture is with Bigfoot. Whether you believe it or not, apparently it sells television programs.
Yeah, it's iconic.
Beef jerky sticks and other things. Right. I mean, it's a joke by half of the population. But hey, there's still, I've looked at polls, there's still anywhere from 18 to 26% of people in the United States in recent surveys believe, say, it's probable or definite that Bigfoot or a similar creature exists. So take that for what it's worth.
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah, and as always, you dig down and there's nothing there, which is always the case.
Nothing but deer hair.
All right, thanks, Evan.
Yep.
Jay, so we got a lot of feedback on our, you know, casual comments about the Starlink satellites. So we need to set the record straight. What's the current status of these satellites? Are they going to ruin astronomy for everybody?
Yeah, this is pretty grim, because what they're doing is they are collecting, you know, going towards each other and turning into a space robot. Have you guys seen pictures of this?
I saw a animation of that once.
Apparently, there's a laser attached to its frickin' head.
And it has a big sword on one arm. Yeah.
I mean, look, this is legit. There's legit concerns here. And in my humble opinion, as a fan of science and a lover of all things outer space, you know, we have to have international rules. And, you know, when people pioneer new areas, these rules or ideas about what the rules should be come up, right? So this is a good microcosm of what we need to do in for the future. We have to think about, like, what impact is what I'm going to do have on humanity, especially when you're going to deploy, I don't know, 12,000 satellites in a very short amount of time. It's a lot of satellites. So these satellites were designed, as we said before, to provide internet service in largely underserved areas. But SpaceX has already launched 60 of the Starlink satellites with a total of 12,000 that are supposed to be launched near a sky near you. yeah, they're going to be everywhere. Now, here's the problem, Jerky, that these satellites are currently in a low Earth orbit, and that makes them visible to the naked eye, just like any other satellite you've ever seen. If you look up in the night sky long enough, you're going to see a white dot moving very fast across the sky. That's a satellite.
I love it. I love satellite watching at night.
Me too.
It's very cool.
It is a lot of fun. I guess the thing here is that there's going to be too many of them, and it's not going to be novel. It's just going to be like, yep, there they are. You know, that's what people and astronomers are worried about. So the basic problem that we have here is that these satellites reflect the sun's light and even light that comes off the Earth, anything, any light that they can get their hands on, they're reflecting, and that makes them highly visible. Now, it is going to have an impact and has already had an impact on sky observation and radio astronomy. But the real question is how much. That's where I think we didn't quite address that or didn't have the information. This item is, you know, this news item is happening right now. You know, so even when you hear this show 3 days after we record it, there might be more information. So one planetary astronomer named Alex Parker, who is from the Southwest Research Institute, SWRI, said that the satellites could be brighter and more numerous than the stars that are currently visible to the naked eye right now. That's scary. You know, imagine the night sky polluted with a lot of fast-moving, reflected star-like things moving across the sky. I mean, we don't want that. And who could disagree? But we have to find out what the truth is going to be. So Elon Musk said a lot of things, and here's what Elon had to say about the whole thing. He said that the orbit of the satellites will go from 273 miles, which is 440 kilometers, up to 342 miles, or 550 kilometers. And at the higher altitude, he said that they're expected to be much less visible. And Musk also said that they can tweak the satellite's orientation during critical astronomical experiments, and this is going to reduce the amount of sunlight that they're going to reflect. And he also said that there are 4,900 satellites currently in orbit, and people notice them 0% of the time. And I'm going to say right now, I disagree with that statement.
Yeah, I noticed them.
We notice them. You know, do they interfere? You know, are they ruining, you know, they harshing my mellow when it comes to me looking up at the night sky? My personal answer is no, but I'm just a casual observer that, you know, pulls out a telescope a few times a year. You know, there are people that live on telescopes, really big telescopes, and this is going to be a much bigger issue to them.
So, well, it's less about your telescope viewing because you only can see a tiny patch of the sky through through a telescope. I think it's more about like stargazing, taking in the whole night sky.
Well, no, I think what Jay's referring to is astronomers who are taking time-lapse photographs of the sky. Satellites already will streak through their field of view, and now that's going to be dramatically increased.
Well, there's a few things here. One is that, like you said, Kara, like, and Steve was saying, yes, when people are taking astronomical pictures and things like that, there's already been a research facility that had to edit their photography or their digital collection because of this. Like, they were interfering with what they were doing, which kind of sucks. You know, but again, these satellites right now, they're in low Earth orbit and they're going to be moving up into a higher orbit, and that's going to change how reflective they are. Also, Elon Musk said that they're going to make the satellites less shiny. They haven't built all 12,000 of them. You know, they're building them and sending them.
Yeah, paint them black.
Yeah, I think they're just making them less reflective, which is the most important thing.
But the solar panels, you can't do that too. So they're still going to have the solar panels, which will occasionally flare, meaning when they align perfectly with the sun so that they reflect the light from the sun at you, you'll see the flare. But yeah, so the initial observation of the bright train of satellites isn't what they're going to ultimately look like because they're going to be higher. Yeah. They're going to be in a different configuration. And I think, you know, it's a good idea to make them less reflective in the future. So it may be true that once the satellites are where they're going to be, you won't notice them unless you're looking for them. That's fine. I accept that. I think what remains to be seen is how much of a menace they're going to be to astronomy, just because there's so many of them, you know?
Musk said something along those lines too, Steve. He said that it won't have an impact on radio astronomy because they don't use the lower KU frequencies used by astronomers, which is good. But you know, I mean, it's not going to...
That's radio astronomy.
Right. But that's part of this. That's part of this, you know, because...
No, for sure. But that's not visible astronomy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm just throwing everything out there. I mean, I'm just trying to update everyone on what the latest information is. You know, astronomers have been challenging what Musk and SpaceX have saying. You know, they're saying that this is going to interfere with the 1 to 2,000 stars that are visible in a clear night, even at the high orbit. And I really, you know, I'm starting to see here that no one really knows until they get up there. And that's going to take 3 to 4 weeks. So it's not a long time from now. They're going to get up there in a very short amount of time, and we're going to be able to see what this first batch, how visible they are and what kind of impact they're going to have on everything. Cause it's all, you know, it's going to be obvious at that point. The good news is that these things are maneuverable. You know, they have these special engines on them, these krypton fueled plasma thrusters. And they, you know, they have electricity with the gyroscopes and they have a high powered antenna. There's lots of features on these, but they can maneuver themselves and they will be avoiding objects and they'll be positioning themselves. And I think that in downtime or in certain circumstances, they'll be positioning themselves so they're less visible. And also they're going to be avoiding other objects in space, which is good. You really shouldn't put anything up there now. That's just dumb. It has to be able to move itself to keep it away from other stuff because all the other stuff up there, the large majority of it is dumb. So everything that goes up now has to be smart. So at least these satellites can do that stuff. But, you know, a part of me, you know, I'm a little like, hey, come on, SpaceX. Like, you got to really already have your thumb on the pulse of things like this. None of these things should be a surprise to a company that wants to launch 12,000 satellites into low Earth orbit. All of this should have already been handled, covered by the press, talked about way before they were launched.
Well, I think the good news is this is kicking off a conversation between Musk and astronomers. And you can't just ignore the effect that, you know, putting 12,000 satellites up there might have on astronomy. Mm-hmm. You should have had a conversation before this started, but at least it's happening now at the very beginning. And we could make adjustments. Maybe we don't need quite as many satellites. They could be less reflective. You could think about, you know, their orbits and orientations or taking, you know, active measures to prevent interfering with observation, whatever. I think Musk means well. And I think this, you know, whenever you do a project this big, there's always going to be a lot of unintended consequences. The question is how you respond to it, right? Mm-hmm. And as I think if he has a constructive conversation with those that are concerned, it'll be fine. But we'll see what happens. You know, this is going to be an evolving story for a while.
It's sad, I guess. My idea here is that it's kind of sad that we have to wait and see what happens before you know, this thing does play itself fully out. And then what if it is the bad, the worst case scenario? Then, you know, I hope that humanity would make the right decision here and pull those freaking things out of the sky. Just to say, no, yeah. The standard, here's the line, don't cross it. And we need those right. standards.
But hopefully it won't come to that, because I think the service that he's trying to provide here is a good one. You know, internet Absolutely. Access in regions that don't have it.
I want this to work.
Yeah, we want it to work. Absolutely. Yeah.
I do too. I know. I'm just playing devil's advocate here. Mm-hmm. What would happen if they were really bad? I'm curious. I don't know.
Yeah, like do we have a contingency for that? Like, how do you even deorbit right. them? Hopefully they do.
Yeah.
Well, they do. The first of all, they do. Well, they will deorbit themselves because they're in a they're low enough that at the end of their lifespan, the atmospheric drag will bring them down, and they're easily deorbitable on purpose. So you could also accelerate that. So that's not going to be a problem. So that's something I do have to give them credit for, because we do talk a lot about space junk and accumulating satellites and other debris up there. And he did think of that and build in deorbiting into the life cycle plan for these satellites. And that's a very good thing.
That's awesome. Yeah. I've never heard
The issue is just like what happens if they need to take them down sooner.
Yeah.
Yeah. They can do that too, apparently.
That's good. Okay.
I found one quote in the little research I did about this that seemed to be properly qualified. This was Jonathan McDowell, an astronomer at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. He said, "My own preliminary calculations indicate that different kinds of astronomy will be affected to different degrees by different proposed mega constellations. I think that the AAS will find that the mega constellations will have a significant effect on astronomy, but that it will be possible to develop design guidelines that won't be too stringent, that will ensure the effect is not disastrous." Mm-hmm. So that seems reasonable mm-hmm. attitude yeah. to be taking on this.
Sure.
Yeah, it's not nothing to have that many satellites up there, but it's a solvable problem. I hope that turns out to be correct.
And there's unknowns. There's still unknowns at this point.
Yep. Okay. All right. Thanks, Jay. All right, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, KiwiCo.
KiwiCo is an amazing company because they create really cool hands-on projects for kids that make learning about science, technology, engineering, art, and math tons of fun. For example, my daughter and I received the other day the build-it-yourself hand crank flashlight, including wired up circuitry and everything else. I'd never built anything like this before, but we dug right into it and had a really good time and learned several things along the way.
So when you get a KiwiCo crate, they include all the supplies you need for that month's project. The instructions are incredibly easy to follow, and there's an educational magazine that is included that you can learn even more about that crate's theme, which is really cool. Like this time I got a for my 3-year-old, which is part of their koala crate, which is really cute because they group them by age range. We got the farm crate, which essentially teaches kids.
You bought the farm?
We bought the farm. Which teaches kids all about farm animals, and they get like the whole thing turns into like a farmhouse, which is like a box that they can carry around with a handle on it, and there's like finger puppets, and teaches them how to grow seeds and stuff like that. It's just really cute.
KiwiCo is offering the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe listeners the chance to try them for free. To redeem this offer and learn more about their projects for kids of all ages, visit kiwico.com/skeptics. That's kiwico.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, Kara, you and I are going to kind of tag team this next one. This is going to be I want to do a major deep dive on this issue. So we were chatting just briefly a couple of weeks ago about the HBO show Chernobyl, which is a great miniseries. But it raises a lot of questions about how historically accurate it is, and even deeper questions about the nuclear power industry. So tell me what you found about the show. So we've seen the whole thing. So what do you think about the whole series, and what do you think about its historical accuracy?
Right. So obviously we're going to dive in soon to all of the things that are dramatized in the series. I think, and I stand firmly behind the position, that this was made to be entertaining and that this was made to tell a really compelling story. And as much as I think that we like to say that there is a responsibility for the filmmaker to be as historically accurate as possible, we were not watching a documentary about Chernobyl. I stand behind the opinion that this was a fantastic scripted miniseries that HBO put out. I thought the acting was phenomenal. I thought that the filmmaking was phenomenal. And I thought that the script and the storytelling was phenomenal. Yes, sure, there are some problems, but I also think that a lot of those problems were flagged by people who don't want fuel to be added to an anti-nuclear fire. Mm-hmm. I don't think that those problems would have been so annoying to people if there weren't already a political movement, an anti-nuclear political movement, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but that's context. That is a context that matters. So this is historical fiction, right? And that's a genre unto itself. We don't expect the, you know, it's the fiction part, right? We don't expect it to be a documentary. It's not accurate. But it kind of depends on what the story is about. The writer of the series, Craig Mazin, said the story is not about nuclear power. It's about the effect of lies and deception in a culture of, you know, fake news, right, of propaganda.
Which is really timely for, you know, I think that's why they chose to do that. It was like, it's as if it were a documentary about Lysenkoism or something like that. It was all about propaganda.
Yeah, and I think that's what we felt was really powerful. And that's what we were reflecting early on, having watched the first couple episodes. But I do think that even though he didn't intend to write a story about nuclear power, he did, because it is such a present character in this story. You can't separate it. You can't totally tease it apart from the more thematic story that he's telling about deception and propaganda.
And I mean, as much as I agree with that to an extent, if you watch this with that filter, because of course I am a massive pro-nuclear advocate, and I never once felt watching this series that there was a fundamental anti-nuclear sentiment within it. Actually, the heroes in this series were nuclear physicists, and they were pro-nuclear to a large degree. There was never a big monologue or speech about how we shouldn't use nuclear energy. It was always about the fact that there were fundamental failures because the Russian government was not willing to admit when they made mistakes.
I agree, but I do think... And that's not the criticism. There isn't a criticism that this is anti-nuclear propaganda. No one is saying that.
I think that is the core of the criticism.
No, no. It's more that it just implicitly depicts nuclear energy as inherently risky.
But it doesn't. I don't think it does, personally. I mean, and the truth is, nuclear energy is, to some extent, inherently risky. Of course it is. It's like one of the most powerful energy sources we can harness. So if you don't do it the right way, well, that's true. So if you don't do it the right way, horrible things can happen. That doesn't mean that after we do the risk-benefit analysis, it's still risky. But yes, there is an inherent risk.
But what about misportraying what those horrible things that could happen actually are? Like the fact that if you have radiation poisoning, it's contagious.
First of all, I kind of disagree with that because, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but this was, did they know? Did all of these nurses and doctors know? Or were they just doing the best they could to try to maintain a safe atmosphere for people?
So that's, I mean, the legitimate point there, Kara, is that, let me just talk about this back up a little bit. We're talking about the difference between radioactive exposure and radioactive contamination. So if you are exposed to radioactivity, you know, the radioactive particles fly through your body, killing cells and doing DNA damage along the way. And that's what, you know, causes radiation sickness, but you are not radioactive. They pass through you. What makes you radioactive is contamination, radioactive contamination. Mm-hmm. When you have radioactive particles on you and that they themselves are radiating. And radioactive contamination is very, very serious. Although, you know, it's questionable about how bad it actually is. The recommendation for how to handle radioactive contamination is, first of all, it's all about time, right? Because radioactivity does damage over time. And the more time you're exposed, the worse. The most important thing is to quickly decontaminate. And 90% of decontamination is just taking your clothes off. Which they did do in this film.
They were in the basement, said at the very end that you still can't go there.
Well, there's still, the clothes are still there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's you're 90% decontaminated just from doing that. And then you wash your skin thoroughly the same way you would a chemical exposure. There's not anything different. And you're 95% decontaminated. So the question is, at that point.
So he's 5% contaminated, and the only scene where this was even an issue was because he had a pregnant wife and they were really concerned about radiation toxicity to the baby, which is a legitimate concern, even if he's 5% contaminated.
But that was probably – there's also a difference between external contamination and internal contamination.
Mm-hmm.
Now, internal contamination is from, you know, when you absorb radioactive particles, mostly iodine in the thyroid. That – you the treatment for that is to enhance the excretion of it. But the question is that I had the hardest time finding a definitive statement about how risky internal contamination is to other people. But the best I could tell, though I couldn't find a definitive source that answered that question explicitly.
That's surprising.
But based on the recommendations that I read, it's not that big a deal. Because water is actually a really, really good blocker of radioactivity. And they're talking about teeny tiny amounts of radiation. It's the fact that it's the duration of exposure. It's like if it's concentrated in your thyroid for years, that's what causes the problem.
Oh, yeah. We've talked about the thing, lining the ships to Mars with water barrier in order to help protect our people traveling.
Did you know?
Cosmic rays and solar radiation.
This is the most interesting thing I discovered in all my research on this. You could swim in those swimming pools that have the radioactive rods at the bottom. It's totally safe.
Like you're actually, I wouldn't
water.
Say totally safe. Wow.
Yeah, you just can't dive deep into them. But you would have to go down pretty deep before you would get exposed. Then you die, right? If you get too close to them, you get very quickly. But you could swim at the surface and even go a little underneath it, and you're fine. It's like I'm not getting any more than background radiation. In fact, when you're under the water, you're getting less radiation than being outside the pool because you're protected from gamma rays. Yeah. But anyway.
That's awesome.
I feel like the one thing we're ignoring here is we're talking about all of this as if, again, from this very particular frame of what we know today and what we know in an effort to not scare people about nuclear power plants.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that's how this series was made. I think they were trying to show you what it was like in 1986.
No, I agree. I'm not saying they were
panicking.
I'm not saying they were trying to scare the audience. I think that I do think that this series, there's evidence to suggest that the series had that inadvertent effect because, and some of that wasn't strictly fact-based or accurate. Like, for example, the show conveyed at the end the Bridge of Death urban legend, which is not, as far as I could tell in my research, is just not true. The idea that everybody who was standing on that bridge looking at the Chernobyl burning is now dead. There's no reference for that. There's no information to back that up. That is, as far as I could tell, an urban legend. And I've read other sources that come to the same conclusion. But that was presented
as fact. Did they say they all died at the end?
Yes. He said, all of the people, they said it's reported that all of those people died, and it's now called the Bridge of Death. That's, you know, that's a dramatic thing to say without really evidence. Yeah.
But here's the thing. It is now called the Bridge of Death, so that's not lying. And the other aspect of it is I think they were airing, and again, this is difficult, right? The story is about propaganda, and the story is about the fact that the Russian government still to this day refuses to admit the extent. And so there are official counts, quote unquote, that are much more conservative than most scholars think are the actual counts. And so I think they preferred to err on the more liberal side of the error bars for this film because the view of the film was that if we just look at official reports from Russia, they're going to say like 6 people died as a result of Chernobyl.
So don't worry about it. The official numbers are
– from Russia.
Well, from – the International, you know, Nuclear Radiation, what was it called? The IAEA, was it the International Atomic Energy? From Russia, but the official number is definitely there's like 32 people who died from that.
Directly.
So that's it was like the 28 first responders, 2 workers at the site, whatever. Mm-hmm. That's definite. Although here's the thing that you would not know from watching the series is that not all of the first responders who got radiation sickness died. A lot of them actually survived. But the question is, how many additional deaths are there going to be over the next 80 years from the radiation in the environment? And that's where there's huge variations in estimates. But you know, again, I've read many, many resources about this, and it's, you know, the numbers are probably the average sort of estimate is probably going to be somewhere around 4,000 to 5,000 additional deaths. There isn't a huge spike in cancer. And again, most of those additional deaths are from thyroid cancer, from radioactive iodine. And if they had just treated people with iodine pills, they could have prevented most of the additional deaths. But it's, you know, you get the impression from watching Chernobyl that the radioactivity in the environment is like really dangerous and causing cancers, and you can't go anywhere near it today. And that was an exaggeration. That's just not true.
You have to get permission, or you do. I mean, you do have to get certain types of permission to go into the exclusion zone. That's not an exaggeration.
The exclusion zone is 30 kilometers, and there are people there. The wildlife is rebounding nicely, and
because they killed most of it.
Yeah, I know. But I'm saying it's coming back. Like, there's wildlife is thriving in the area around Chernobyl now. It's actually not that bad. Because again, you're left with this impression that you have a nuclear accident and then we have this huge contaminated area that will never be able to populate again. That's just not true.
But they didn't say any of that.
But that's the impression that people are coming away from this series with.
And here's another impression, Steve. Here's another impression that kind of annoys me. Did you know that nuclear energy is a safest form of energy that we have, by orders of magnitude, safer than fossil fuel, solar, wind, safer, and you could even
what
say
by what measure though?
Deaths per terawatt. If you say that deaths per terawatt,
deaths of people per terawatt, not of animals,
right? People deaths per terawatt. Nuclear power is the safest by orders of magnitude, even if you include Chernobyl, Fukushima, and everything.
Of course, of course. And you could also say that nuclear power has, in fact, saved millions of lives just purely from the air pollution alone. You could say it saved millions. I mean, you don't walk away from this series with that impression,
but
that
that's
I just
not
related
the point
at
the
all.
Series.
I agree.
I know,
I agree,
but it still annoys the crap out of me.
But that's the thing that's kind of bothering me about this. I feel like there's this big skeptical outcry of people being like, why didn't they do a public service announcement for nuclear energy? And it's like, well, that's not what they were doing. Yeah. That's not their job.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect that from them
either. No, I would give them much more slack dramatically, thematically. That's fine. But when the science is wrong or misrepresented or dramatized.
When is the science wrong?
When the baby got absorbed all the radiation.
Yeah, that was
born baby and.
No, they said that. They said you lived because your baby absorbed the radiation. That was just pure pseudoscience.
You mean when the woman at the end in the title card, when it said she gave birth and the baby died, but she lived?
Yes.
Yeah, nobody said that out loud. They just said that.
Well, I thought it was said out loud, but it might have been in the words at the end. You're right. But it was in the show that she survived because the baby absorbed the radiation, which is because
you're right. If they said that, that's irresponsible.
So in any case, I mean, it's interesting conversation. I'm glad that it's sparking a conversation about it because there is a lot of interesting facts that come out of it. And I wrote about the Chernobyl series after it was done, and it sparked a massive debate in the comments about nuclear energy. So I had to write a follow-up about it, just answering all the questions that were raised, which I'm going to get to in just a second. But I wanted to bring up one more narrative point. So some have criticized the show. This is a narrative criticism, not a science criticism, that there was too much emphasis on the failure of individuals. And that kind of takes away from the bigger narrative that it really was a systemic failure. The Chernobyl didn't happen because that guy made a mistake.
They did make it all about that one guy, didn't they?
Yeah. They focused.
Well, there were three of them, but they really only targeted the one.
Yeah.
One villainous engineer.
Who had no positive qualities,
right?
Whatsoever.
Oh my gosh. Talk about negative. Ooh. Yeah.
And yes, that guy did screw up. But the point, I think it would have been a more powerful point, some have argued, and I tend to agree with this, that this was inevitable because of the systemic failures in this, in the system, and really you can't really just blame for this one guy's greed or whatever. This wouldn't have happened.
They consistently, like minute after minute in the series, showed like, and I think that the guy who played the Sarsgaard guy who played like sort of the sympathetic party man was representative of the fact that everybody within this system was doing their duty for the party. But that's a device that all films have to do. Do you guys remember The Imitation Game?
Yeah.
You guys saw that, right?
Turing?
Yeah, about Turing. And there was one woman And yes. She was supposed to represent every woman at Bletchley Park.
Oh,
yeah.
It's because
right.
You can't.
It was not an actual character.
Yeah, I know.
Right?
You always
like,
yeah, she was
Watson
an amalgamation of like hundreds of women.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, the Emily Watson character was the same. She didn't really exist. That's
yeah.
She was an amalgamation of 100 scientists who helped him. Yeah.
But I think that that's okay.
Yeah, I think that's okay too.
Yeah,
I don't have a problem with that.
That's fine. No, I didn't have a problem with that one. Steve, I'll take it a step further, even, and then you can go on to your next point. It, not only is it a problem with the system, it's a problem with Soviet science in its entire history. How about that? Mm-hmm. I mean, you go back to Lysenkoism, and there are so many examples of absolute technological and scientific abominations and failures within the Soviet system. It accumulated over generations, leading to these deficiencies in which you had these sorts of places in which they built these kinds of reactors that nobody else on the planet was building. Because why? Because it was cheap. And that is when it came down to the economics of the failed Soviet system had a direct link to this. And that, mm-hmm. I think, is being understated in this series. That's what I took away
you
from
do?
The show. Oh, absolutely.
I feel like that's the whole point
I thought
of
that was
series.
Powerful in the series. But
yeah. I don't know. I guess I just really disagree with the concept that this series on when you weigh everything was like somehow has like a negative social effect. Yeah, sure. Maybe it's going to embolden some people who already think nuclear energy is evil. But I don't think it's going to flip anybody into thinking this is a historical thing that happened. It's not like this is new. You can read about Chernobyl anytime you want to. And I don't think it's going to make people go, oh, my God, now that I've watched Chernobyl, I think nuclear power is dangerous.
But people are saying that. But people are saying that. I mean, there are people
sad.
There are people quoted like, in the articles I'm reading about it. They're quoting people who are saying exactly that because it's a big dramatic event, even though the deeper lesson is about propaganda, et cetera. And science can't thrive in a culture of lies. But people are walking away with like, oh my goodness, how close is the nearest nuclear plant to my home? You know,
right. And nuclear is already a boogeyman in society.
That's only because those people obviously don't know anything about, like they had never heard of Chernobyl before.
All right. So let's shift gears and talk about nuclear energy. Because when I wrote about Chernobyl, the misinformation was flying. And so I did a deep dive. I mean, not that I wasn't starting from ground zero. And like you, Kara,
so to speak,
I don't even call myself pro-nuclear. I'm pro-science, right? Just like I'm not pro-GMO. Yeah. Like I'm pro-science. But I don't think that we should take nuclear energy off the table in our plans to decarbonize our energy infrastructure. And I'll explain to you why. But let me address the specific points that came up. One, of course, was safety. And as we mentioned, nuclear is, if you talk about deaths per terawatt, it's safer than solar. It's safer than wind. It's safer than any other form of energy production. But another thing people say, okay, but what about the nuclear waste?
Mm-hmm.
And nuclear waste is actually, first of all, the very idea of nuclear quote-unquote waste is in a sense biased. There really isn't any such thing as waste. It's just spent nuclear fuel. It's
no
different.
Well, you're talking about from power plants. You're not talking about from development of weapons.
Yeah, so everything
shitload of nuclear waste.
Everything I'm talking about has to do with nuclear energy. I'm not talking about nuclear weapons because that's, and I think a lot of people confuse that those two
they
things.
They do. We have a whole salt mine in Arizona where I told you guys about visiting there.
Yeah,
that's almost all from nuclear labs where they were developing weapons, like all the gloves, all the whatever.
It's a totally different story. I agree.
Yeah.
So let's just restrict ourselves to nuclear energy.
Okay.
The only difference between nuclear fuel and quote-unquote waste, which is really spent nuclear fuel, is what we can utilize in the design of our reactors. But there's also the true waste are things that get contaminated with nuclear material. It was never fuel. It's not fuel. It's the graphite or whatever that's now contaminated. But that's actually low level. Those are low level nuclear waste. It's actually not that bad. The high level nuclear waste is the spent fuel, but actually there's nothing definitive about it that makes it waste. It's just a matter of our own technology. And that's important when we start to talk about generation four nuclear reactors, which can burn a lot of what we now consider to be waste. They can even burn the waste from older reactors.
Yeah, the waste becomes fuel.
Yeah, the waste is fuel if we can use it as fuel. So they say, well, we don't have a way of disposing of the waste. We do. We have the technology to safely dispose of nuclear waste. Yucca Mountain, for example, we just don't have the political will to do it. And while that's a legitimate point that we don't have the political will to do it, my whole point is, well, we need the political will. The need to decarbonize our energy infrastructure has to weigh greater than the NIMBY, I don't want nuclear waste stored in my state crap that's going on. So also, if we move to Gen 4, next generation power plants, they produce a lot less waste. They might actually have a net negative impact on nuclear waste because they could burn the spent fuel from older reactors. And what we do have to store, we can perfectly safely store in facilities like Yucca Mountain. It's really not a problem, is the bottom line. You know, once you deal with the waste issue and the safety issue, another thing that people say is that it's too late. It takes too long to build nuclear power plants. And I say that's nonsense. In 10 to 20 years, we're still going to need some kind of a baseload power. And we will not have completely decarbonized our infrastructure. And I bet you anything that 20 years from now, the anti-nuclear people will say we should have built them 20 years ago, which is exactly what they're saying now. But the big issue, here's the biggest objection that I encountered. When you say, all right, nuclear's, it's safe, it's effective, we could deal with the waste, we can build them in time, we're definitely going to need them to decarbonize our infrastructure. They say, okay, but solar and wind are better and cheaper. And the economics of nuclear is too expensive and the economics don't work out. That was the biggest objection I encountered. And that objection is dead wrong. And it's completely naive about the nature of our energy infrastructure. Now, I did a lot of research, but I think the best single resource I came across was a one-hour lecture by a Harvard scientist who's an expert on this, Jesse Jenkins. He's an environmental fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. We'll link to this in the notes. If you are interested in this topic, watch that entire one-hour lecture, but I'm going to give you the quickie overview. There are basically three strategies for balancing the demand and production in our energy infrastructure, right? So at the end of the day, we have to produce as much energy as we need, right? So there's three types of things that we do in the energy production infrastructure. One is renewables, right, which are that basically a strategy for reducing resources needed to produce energy because they're renewable, right? That's their big advantage. Their disadvantage, of course, is that they're intermittent. They're not on demand. They're not continuous. We get wind when the wind blows and solar when the sun shines. And we can't control that. The second type is fast reactive energy. So these are things that we can turn on and off at the flip of a switch, right? So the big thing that right now that we're using for fast is things like natural gas powered plants. Natural gas plants, we could turn them on and off very, very quickly to meet peak demand, you know, or to fill in holes. When the wind stops blowing, we turn on the gas. Another one, however, that fills that role is any kind of short-term storage, like battery storage, right? And in fact, there are utilities that are building battery storage facilities instead of gas power plants.
Cool.
Because they're cheaper. But also you could put into that category things like demand flexibility, like charging your electric car at 3 a.m. So using electricity off peak. So whenever you could shift demand to flatten out or smooth out the demand curve, right? So that's all fast things you could do in the moment immediately to flatten out demand or production. The third pillar is what's now being called firm production, which I think previously was referred to as baseload production. And that's essentially always or mostly on. These are things that can slowly be turned on and off. Or if we know, like, okay, peak solar production is between these hours, so we're going to turn down some of our production during these hours, but it's predictable, right? But there's some flexibility in there, but it's not a fast reaction. It's a slow reaction. But mainly you're producing at a steady rate. And that's things like nuclear or coal-fired plants or hydroelectric plants or geothermal, right? Those are the big things in that category. Now, what a lot of people are saying is, well, we don't need nuclear because we have wind and solar. But what they're doing is they're crossing categories. There isn't a choice between nuclear and solar, right? Because they serve completely different functions in the mix of energy. And what Jenkins' lecture is about is like, all right, what if we try to get to deep decarbonization with just the first two types of energy, like basically renewables and storage? How will that look compared to renewables, storage, and firm production, hydroelectric, geothermal, and nuclear, assuming we're phasing out coal? He also includes in there carbon capture, like burning natural gas and capturing all of the carbon. That would also be in that category, right? And he very convincingly shows, and this is from researching and running simulations with hundreds of possible outcomes in terms of how the technology is going to evolve and what choices economically are people going to make, like hundreds of scenarios. And what you end up with is, without the firm production, nuclear, right, essentially taking up the bulk of that, without that, it's actually a lot more expensive. So even though nuclear is more expensive as an individual choice, it's a lot more expensive to try to get to deep decarbonization with only renewables and battery. The reason for that is because the greater the penetration of renewables, the more expensive they get. Part of the reason is because the way you get to deep penetration of renewables is by demand sharing, right? So if the wind is blowing in one area, you send electricity to areas where the wind is not blowing, right? But in order to do that, you need a lot of overcapacity. You need to be able to generate a lot more electricity than you need, because you have capacity in reserve that is, you know, sharing energy across the country. Does that make sense? It's like if you have windmills in the eastern part of the country that could serve the entire country when the wind's blowing in the east, and windmills in the west that can serve the entire country when the wind is blowing in the west. But that means you have twice the capacity to serve the whole country. So deep penetration of renewables requires a lot of overcapacity, which means the money you make off that next solar panel goes down geometrically when you get above like 60% penetration. It starts to really, really nosedive. And so it actually is the more expensive option to try to get to greater than 60% penetration with purely renewables. If you add nuclear into the mix, your overall energy production is cheaper, even though nuclear itself is very expensive. Does that make sense?
Yeah, interesting.
In order to have deep penetration, you also, this is the other huge point, you not only need a lot of overcapacity, which means that solar and wind have to become a lot cheaper than they even already are in order to afford it. You also need the ability to share electricity across the continent. So we need to massively update our grid. You also need a lot more storage than we currently have or really have the ability to create. And that storage needs to become much cheaper than it is. All of those things need to happen simultaneously in order for renewables to get deep penetration in terms of energy production. But if we're talking about firm production, the sort of mostly on or slowly reactive, you know, heavy production, we only need any one of the many options to work out, right? So some people say, oh, geothermal is the wave of the future. Fine. If that works out, great. But there are reasons why we don't have geothermal everywhere. It's because we're picking the low hanging fruit, and we're building it in the perfect locations. And we've run out. We're running out of perfect locations. Here's the variable. We may be able to extend the locations with essentially using fracking to create the conditions necessary to have a geothermal plant. You basically need magma coming close to the surface. You need water. You need porous rock all in the same place. or pumped hydro. People saying, oh, we could put pumped hydro anywhere. Yes, but we've picked the low-hanging fruit, and the farther away you get from that, the more expensive it gets. Now we're going to create upper and lower reservoirs with massive construction projects and get the water from somewhere. And where are we getting all of this fresh water? The problem is trying to solve the energy problem with a single solution. You end up getting, you know what I mean? It's just inherently the wrong approach. We want to pick the low-hanging fruit of every different solution and not push one to extremes. The numbers don't add up. And the more you try to push any one solution, the more expensive, the less practical, the harder it gets. So the best thing to do is to have a mix of everything. It also dramatically increases our odds of being able to decarbonize the infrastructure if we're spreading our bets around as much as possible. So how good an option is nuclear going forward? It totally depends on how well the Gen 4 reactors work out. But I've read a lot about them over the last week, and they're looking really good. So Gen 4 reactors use higher temperatures and lower pressure, so they're a lot safer. They're smaller, cheaper, more adaptable. They burn more of their fuel. They produce less waste. They could even recycle the waste of older reactors in some of the designs. Here's one cool thing. The salt-cooled reactors.
Yeah.
Yeah, you mix the rods with salt, and the salt expands as it heats up, so it automatically moves the rod, the fuel farther apart. And,
clever.
And so, yeah, it automatically – so even if you leave the system alone and there's nobody there to man it and there's no power or whatever, it will automatically, you know, shut down the reaction by expanding from the heat. There's sort of a – it's a built-in safety valve. Yeah. So it's a lot safer. It basically can't melt down. Right.
So that means then that when the zombies take over and civilization ends, that the reactors won't blow up.
They won't melt down. That's right. Excellent. That's exactly right. Here's another thing. I found this awesomely cool. Some of the Gen 4 reactors produce electricity and hydrogen. Think about how cool that is, because they're not only producing electricity, they are producing a form of energy storage. They're adding to our fast reactive portfolio. That's a two-in-one win for the electrical system. It's covering two of the three pillars in one device.
Sweet.
Yeah. So anyway, the probability of deeply decarbonizing our energy infrastructure by 2050, let's say, is much greater if we include nuclear in the mix. We are simply not going to get there with renewables alone. It's not going to happen. There isn't any one technology that's going to save our ass. Like, oh, we're going to have geothermal everywhere. It's probably not going to happen, right? And we can't count on a technological breakthrough we haven't made yet as the solution. We have to use existing technology or predictable incremental extrapolations from existing technology. We can't count on a breakthrough. We can't count on fusion, for example. We can't count. If it happens, fantastic. But honestly, the best chance of avoiding the worst outcomes of global warming through deep decarbonization of our energy infrastructure is the all of the above. We need to do everything. We need a good mix of firm production, renewable production, and fast reactive, basically storage, which is probably going to mostly be batteries. We have to phase out coal as quickly as possible. So again, the bottom line here, if you say we don't need nuclear because of renewables, you fundamentally misunderstand how the whole system works. The choice is not between nuclear and renewables. It's right now, from a practical point of view, it's between nuclear and coal. That's the choice. And if our choice is between nuclear production and coal fire plants, that's a no-brainer. That's a no-brainer. Did you know that burning coal produces more radioactivity than burning nuclear fuel in a nuclear reactor?
Nope.
It actually puts more radioactivity into the environment than nuclear power plants, because coal contains uranium and thorium, and when we burn it, guess where it goes? It either goes up in smoke or it gets concentrated in the nuclear fly ash. So you actually have more radioactive waste from coal burning, especially dirty coal, than you do from nuclear power plants. So it's really a no-brainer, in my opinion, if we're going to compare. And it's also deaths, you know, the pollution from fossil fuels. Again, it's like nuclear saves millions of lives compared to coal. That's really the choice. The choice is not between solar and nuclear. It's between, we want solar and nuclear. The choice is between nuclear and coal. And that's really, from a practical point of view, what we're facing. Sure, let's maximize hydroelectric. Sure, let's maximize geothermal. But chances are they're not going to be nearly enough. And our best bet of getting to that 40, 50% firm production so that we can optimize the benefits of renewables, our best bet of getting there and without coal, without fossil fuels, is nuclear. That's why, that's what, that I do think that's the consensus of the experts in this area, Although there, yes, there are lots of opinions. There are definitely people pushing for the, like their one thing that they want. But, the most compelling cases that I've heard from Jenkins and others strongly supports putting down some bets on the Gen 4 nuclear reactors. And we have to just deal with the political problems. We just need to marshal the political will. I think part of that is going to be taxing carbon. You know, if you tax the hell out of carbon, nuclear power becomes a lot more cost effective. Don't let the coal burning plants externalize the cost of their pollution and their carbon. And you do that, get rid of fossil fuel subsidies, tax carbon instead, and suddenly we're off to the races. We're not going to fix this problem without it. That is a pretty solid conclusion once you do a deep dive on all the evidence, in my opinion. I'm happy to be proven wrong if somebody has other information, but before you email me or give me a different opinion, I implore you to watch that full lecture by Jesse Jenkins. And then if you have a different opinion, I'm happy to hear it, because you really have to understand, I think, the situation at that, at least that superficial level, before you could think about what we should be doing with our energy infrastructure in the future.
Okay. Can we go back to Chernobyl for a second?
Yeah. Give me what you got. What do you got?
Let's revisit Chernobyl.
Revisiting. All right. So the two things that I'm finding in almost every write-up that people are annoyed about that are like fictions from Chernobyl are the Bridge of Death and the baby absorbing.
Yeah. Those are the two.
Yeah. And I, not to defend either of them, because I do completely understand that neither of those things are true. It is true that at the end they said people say that nobody survived, and that is a massive wives' tale that has persisted. Yes, they probably should have debunked it. Unfortunately, some researchers, the only actual debunking that I've been able to find is that one historian found one guy who did survive. Okay. So really, the answer is we don't know. We do know that everybody didn't die. But we don't know how many people survived and didn't, because it was poorly reported.
Yeah.
The other thing I found, which is kind of interesting, there's a book called Chernobyl Prayer, Voices from Chernobyl, that was written in 2016 by Svetlana Alexievich. And I think it was used as research for a lot of this film. It's about the history of Chernobyl. This woman won a Nobel Prize in Literature, the writer of it. And she interviewed several people who were there. She interviewed the woman, Ludmilla, whose baby died.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman recounted in this film that that's what the doctors told her. And okay. That's probably why that ended up in the film, because it came straight from the horse's mouth.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean it was true, but that was the narrative that she was told when her baby passed.
Right.
So yeah, there you go.
I'm sure that's true. But the thing is, it still leaves this misinformation in the public consciousness, you know.
I get it. But I do think that, you know, when it comes to like literary and historical fiction and things like that, I think actually being more true to the time is in some ways more important than making a political commentary. And I think that they actually did a very good job of researching these things and being true to the time. And one thing that I'm kind of annoyed when I read all these like skeptic sites being like, Chernobyl got everything wrong and it's really dangerous and I'm really concerned about the backlash from it, is nobody's talking about the amazing scenes where they talked about how nuclear energy works and how much it educated people on how a reactor actually works. I thought that scene when he was doing the blue and the red cards –
mm-hmm.
And talk, you know, at the hearing and talking about how like this went wrong and then this went wrong. And then at that point, they couldn't get it back, was like a brilliant piece of science communication. They made it so accessible. And this is complicated shit. and they made it so accessible for somebody who doesn't have any background in physics. So I don't know. I think it's very easy to be polemical, especially when it's something that you had nothing to do with. It's very easy to be an armchair critic.
Oh yeah, I agree with that.
You know, and so like this, I would hate for, at least coming from me, for the vibe to be like, yes, there were a couple things that were maybe a little overly dramatized and fictionalized, but I think that this was actually one of the better pieces of historical drama that has ever been made in television.
Yeah, I mean, the story that he wanted to tell about the insidious effects of propaganda, it was powerful and timely and worked really well.
And it was a really good show. Like,
and it was just a really good show.
I personally think it was a really good show. Yeah. So don't
maybe
don't
Craig Mazin should, except maybe Craig Mazin shouldn't have said, and he's being quoted, accuracy is everything to us. So I think he set himself up for an unfortunate backlash with a statement like that.
But guys, we are biased. We are looking at this from a scientific lens, and he is looking at it from a historical lens. And it was accurate from a historical lens. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. All right, let's move on.
Okay.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, the Rochester Institute of Technology.
The faculty and students at Rochester Institute of Technology have been getting inspired by the great outdoors. So their latest project started with the keen observation of the short, powerful, yet simple muscle movements of the common river trout. The team at RIT ended up replicating the movements of the river trout with elastomeric material, which is cool. This is it's super strong. It's a stretchy fiber, and it carries an electrical charge to create a fully submersible robot fish. Bob, a robot fish.
It's the best kind of fish.
The researchers at RIT said that this technology could lead to a new wave of prosthetics that help amputees regain their fine motor skills.
Yeah, you know, it is cool. I think that, you know, having soft robotic muscles essentially is going to be a critical technology for our robotic future.
Agreed.
The team of creative engineering students is using design thinking and innovative technology to prove that at RIT, they're on to something life-changing. Learn more about the project at rit.edu/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Jay.
Yes.
It's Who's That Noisy time.
Okay, guys, last week I played this noisy. What is it?
Oh, that's a warning if a nuclear reactor's
going. If you hear that noise, duck and cover.
It sounds very like 8-bit from the 80s.
Yeah, it's 8-bit. Yeah.
Definitely Atari-esque.
Yeah. It's an R2-D1.
No.
Prototype.
So a friend of the show, Evil Eye, said, I'm guessing it's the ringtone on the first hand bag style Motorola or Ericsson portable phone. That's not correct, but that's a cool guess.
Yeah.
And then we're getting a little closer now. This guy named Sam McLeod. Sam said, this week's noisy reminded me of the old game, the Oregon Trail, a bit like when your whole family team dies. But I have a feeling I'm wrong. Also,
how are you doing? Of dysentery.
Yeah, remember that?
I love Oregon Trail. That was like definitive of my childhood.
I know. That game is still fun. You can still play it online. So awesome. The winner for last week, Nathaniel Arnold. He said, my time has come. This week's noisy is 100% the sound
of the pipe. My time has come. I loved it.
It's the sound of the pipe warp damage shrink in Super Mario Brothers, slowed down in tempo but not pitch.
What?
I know this.
Come on.
Yes. I totally believe him because I know this because I wanted to recreate the noise in a song using different instruments. So hear it again. All right, now here it is, cool. And I'm so excited to play this to you guys.
Oh, that noise.
Oh, yes. That's from Mario Bros.
Listen again. Here it is, slowed down. Here it is, sped up. Normal speed. Ready?
Oh, my God. Damn. Nice.
What a cool idea to slow that sound down.
Yeah,
I also
awesome.
Find it fascinating because that sound makes like a very... It doesn't sound like it does when it's slow at all.
No, it's good. Yeah. It's got a different gestalt.
It's an aggregate sound.
Yes.
Yeah, kind of rings, that's, you know?
Good use of that word, Bob.
I love that word.
Yeah. Okay, so very fun this week, guys, and very good job. Nathaniel, great. I mean, I'm clapping right now in my head to you. Very good job, man. I have a new noisy this week. Tell me what you can about this.
This is not another flying saucer scare.
That's a guy saying, this is not another flying saucer.
One of those 1950 educational film voices.
If you think you know what this is, I mean, even you, Kara, you can email me.
Okay. All right. I could just text you.
Or call me. if you think you know what this noisy is this week, or if you heard something really cool, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. All right. We have two emails, both corrections. The first one is a correction of a correction, which I both love and hate. But that's okay. Here it goes. This comes from Isaac from Virginia. Hey, guys, I just listened to today's episode. Stephen doubled down that Venus gets closest to Earth and is closest on average, but I'm pretty sure the latter is incorrect. Mercury is the closest for most of the time, and its average distance to Earth is smallest, not Venus. Indeed, it is, on average, the closest planet to every other planet. This was the point made by More or Less, which really is a great podcast, and he gives a link. Okay, so we're talking about, like, what's the closest planet to the Earth? And there's multiple ways to interpret that. Venus comes the closest to the Earth at any time. And at any point in time, either Mars, Venus, or Mercury can be closest. The question was, which one has the shortest average distance to the Earth? Now, I looked up multiple seemingly reliable references like Universe Today, Space, National Geographic. They all say that Venus has the shortest average distance to the Earth. And so usually when I triple reference something from reliable sources and it makes sense to me, that's usually
gold standard.
Enough. Yeah, that's a reasonable standard. However, it turns out that they're all wrong.
Oh my God. They're
all wrong because everybody's wrong, because the scientific community has been getting this wrong for years, because they were basically, the scientists were doing the math wrong, because math is often not intuitive. And they were using a simple calculation to figure out the average distance, but they really weren't doing the complicated math necessary. And so mathematicians found the real answer, and they made a much more complicated formula to calculate what the average distance between two circular orbits would be. And then they ran They ran a simulation in a computer over 10,000 years. And it matched up with their mathematical calculation. And when you do that, yes, Mercury has the shortest average distance to every other planet in the solar system. That's because its deviation from the sun is the smallest.
Yeah,
sure. And makes sense because it's closest.
And not only does it get less farther away when it's on the other side of the sun, it also gets less farther away when it's to the side. So like it doesn't go as far out to either side either at any given point in time. And so for that reason, mathematically, it works out that it has the shortest average distance. So yeah, so that was just science had it wrong. It was recently corrected by a mathematician. That correction checks out. It seems pretty definitive. So there you go. So,
but it violates the entire spirit of the question. It's fascinating.
Well, I still think that, you know, my interpretation of the question is what is the closest planet to the Earth, is what planet comes closest to the Earth.
Which planet comes closest is the
most intuitive definition. And yet that is Venus. But when I made the correction, I broke it out and I the references I used were incorrect. So there you go. All right. This next one, Kara, you're going to answer. This is a follow-up. I'm not going to read any individual email because we got so many millions of them.
Yeah.
This is a follow-up on the are married women happy or not? So tell us what you found.
Yeah. So this was based on the Paul Dolan comments that were reported in The Guardian, where he said kind of point blank, and it's, you know, leading to a book that he's selling right now, that married women are unhappy compared to unmarried women. And this was based on a survey. And it turns out, the American Time Use survey, it turns out that the way that it actually was worded in the survey was like husband absent. And he misinterpreted it as husband absent from the room when asked. And that's what he reported, that when married women's husbands were out of the room, they were less happy than when they were in the room. But it actually meant the husband was out of the home. Like maybe they were deployed in the military or they worked a job that was far away. So, of course, when married women's husbands didn't live at home with them, they were less happy than when married women's husbands did live at home with them. So that was where all the confusion came in. But apparently Paul Dolan stands by his claim that unmarried women, because he says it's not just based on that. And there is, I've been looking, there's actually a lot of evidence that shows that married women report being happier, but that people with children report being less happy.
So yeah, because raising really little kids is stressful. It's the most wonderful experience of your life, but it's massively stressful.
But I can tell you that if you were to weigh all that out, when you look at these surveys, on average, people who don't have kids rate themselves as being happier than people who have kids.
But they're less fulfilled. Where it got
I would disagree.
Oh, that's such a lame statement.
All right, but what about?
I think it depends on the kid.
What about people who have raised kids? What about people with older kids who now can take care of you?
I think that's part of the survey. I don't think they're just asking people with little kids. Yeah, it's part of the survey.
Yeah, but you could just have your butlers take care of you with all the money you save.
Exactly.
Come on.
my robots will carry me around.
I think the thing that caused a big outcry, like a lot of people when this came out got really pissy because they're like, he misrepresented the data. And like, that can't possibly be true, which is true. So like, he's issued a correction, blah, blah, blah. But I do think that I've read some interesting, you know, kind of op-ed articles that are sort of like, the point here is not that married women are happy, unmarried women are unhappy, people with kids are unhappy, people without kids are happy. I think the point here that is an important social commentary to make that's still important is that marriage is not a prerequisite for happiness.
Yeah, that's
that there are
five,
plenty of
course.
People who are going to live their entire lives unmarried and not have children, and it doesn't mean that they're somehow not fully people or that they somehow aren't experiencing life in a way that is ever going to be fulfilling to them.
I think it's also individual.
Bullshit.
I think it's individual.
Absolutely individual.
I can't imagine living my life without having kids, but there are other people who can't imagine having kids, and that's fine.
Yeah.
Good for you.
I'm right here. Yeah exactly. I blows my mind to think about what it would be like. So that's the thing that I think is important, is that like, instead of passing judgment about people based on these kinds of random self-report things where we look at amalgam, you know, all this research and literature, you got to start to tease stuff out, right? Most people are going to be married at some point in their life. So right there, the ends are really not level.
Yeah.
At any given time, some people will be unmarried and some people will be married. But over the lifespan, most people will be married. So if you look at people like me who have chosen as a lifestyle to never get married, we represent a very small percentage. And so you're always going to have some statistical anomalies that happen there. Also, many people who aren't married because they're divorced. So of course, they're going to say that they were unhappy.
Yeah, right.
So there's a lot of stuff that goes into this.
It's a complicated question.
It's really complicated.
Some of us remarry.
Some people do. And that's the thing. Like, the truth of the matter is, I don't think we have solid social science evidence in this area yet. It's an active area of research. So it's sort of like the jury's a bit out. But it is true that he made a technical error when he misrepresented the data there. And he corrected the record. Hopefully he's correcting it in his book that's coming out. So we need to correct that record there.
Absolutely.
Too. There you go.
Okay. Thank you, Kara.
All right.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to sniff out the fake. All right, we got three regular news items this week. You guys ready?
Yes. Sure.
All right.
Yes.
Here we go. Item number one. A new study finds that having higher education levels has a protective effect against developing Alzheimer's disease. Item number two, a new review of 3,000 studies from three top medical journals found almost 400 current medical practices that represent reversals or practices deemed not to add to patient outcomes. And item number four, a new analysis finds that Bitcoin requires as much energy, 45.8 terawatt hours, as Kansas City.
Oh my God.
All right, Kara, go first.
Okay. I have to reread them because when you were reading the medical journal one, I was like, say what now? What? A new study finds that having higher education levels has a protective effect against developing Alzheimer's disease. Ah, crap. That one seems so face value, like yes, but it's probably no. because Alzheimer's is organic, but it's like, are we specifically talking about Alzheimer's, not dementia, like all the other types of dementia that might have a cognitive load, like kind of protective component with learning? A new review of 3,000 studies from three top medical journals found that almost 400 current medical practices that represent reversals or practices deemed not to add to pay. I don't understand.
Yeah. So in other words, this is something that physicians are doing now, but but the studies that they reviewed said this actually doesn't work, or it's not worthwhile. It's not better than older, cheaper, better practices,
it's
whatever.
It's not the standard of care.
Totally buy that.
Yeah.
If anything, I would think that this was 4,000 current practices instead of 400.
From I'm going to say that 3,000 studies?
You're right. In 3,000 studies, that doesn't make sense. But maybe in 30,000 studies. No, I think that, 3,000 studies, big review. Sure, there's definitely 3,000 studies out there. 400 current medical practices. Yeah, because you could probably slice and dice them into like each little thing that's named. Like, oh, this kind of technique for suturing that somebody invented in order to be like, look at me, I made things better, is no better than the way they used to do. I could totally buy this. A new analysis finds that Bitcoin requires as much energy as Kansas City. I kind of buy this too. I know that Bitcoin mining is like insanely energy intensive. It could be even more than this. It could be as much as like, well, as like a whole state. I don't know how 45.8 terawatt hours is a meaningless number to me. So my only thing is that like this one could be fiction, because it's actually more than that, like 458 terawatt hours. So maybe as much as the state of like, I don't know, Montana or something. Maybe I'll go ahead and say that this one is science and that the Alzheimer's one is fiction, that really it's other types of dementia, but that Alzheimer's is Alzheimer's. You're going to get it if you have the genetic disposition for it.
Okay,
Bob. Of your education level. All right.
Start with three, Bitcoin. Yeah, I mean, I just don't know much about it, but that doesn't really rub me the wrong way as much as Kara. Yeah, whatever. Number two, the 300 studies. Yeah, I mean, I would think that these wouldn't be dramatic things that are, it's kind of like a drift, you know, things that have drifted a bit that don't contribute, but they're not big deals for the most part. That would kind of make sense, but yeah, the Alzheimer one, I can't disagree, and yeah, that one sounds like fiction to me.
Okay, Evan,
The Alzheimer's one, boy, my memory must be bad because I thought we talked about this 10 years ago on the show.
Hi-yo.
No, seriously though, I could have sworn this had come up before, and there was supposed to be some sort of protective effect, but I don't. Did it have to do with Alzheimer's or memory loss in all cases, not specifically Alzheimer's? If only I could remember. No joke. The other one that's bothering me is the Kansas City and the Bitcoin one. I don't know about that one. But Kara, Bob, I'm going to go with you guys. I'll say it's the Alzheimer's one.
We go with the crowd.
And yeah, crowdsourcing.
Okay.
All right, Jay.
So I've been thinking this over heavily, Steve.
Yeah.
The first one about the Alzheimer's bothers me because – you don't like when you say it protects against developing Alzheimer's, like you could, I think, help yourself by being mentally active, but you can't prevent the disease from taking place. You could just push off the effects, right? Other people said that, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's why I agree with that. I also agree with what Kara said, like the 400 current medical practices that represent reversals. Like, yeah, wouldn't it be 4,000? But okay, so at least 400. No problem with that. And the final one here about the Bitcoin thing, I mean, seemingly sad but true. Like, I agree with that statement. I think Kansas City is oddly using as much power as Bitcoin, and Kansas City should just turn their power over to Bitcoin.
That's so mean.
Call it Bitcoin City.
Yeah. So I'm going to follow Kara's lead on this one.
All right.
Oh, boy.
Okay, so let's start with number two, because it seems like you guys had the easiest time with that one. A new review of 3,000 studies from three top medical journals found almost 400 current medical practices that represent reversals or practices deemed not to add to patient outcomes. You all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Scary.
Yes.
Yeah, it was 396 specifically. Mm. The three top journals were JAMA, New England Journal of Medicine and The Lancet. They looked at a number of studies, 3,000, and looking specifically to see, like, did the practices that they were studying, you know, first of all, they had to be in current use. Were they, did they show that they work? Did they show that they didn't work, or was it inconclusive? And the number that ultimately showed it didn't work was 400. This is actually the extension of research, by Prasad et al. What's interesting is, I was giving a lecture yesterday, which is the day that this was published, where I was referencing his older work. And now I have to update my slides because this is what this guy found previously. And this is just, he's just continuing to extend the survey, you know, and showing, and the results are pretty much holding up. So this, I use this as an, it's not that surprising. So first of all, we're studying things that need to be studied, right? The things, the reason why these, there are studies being published about these practices is because we weren't sure if they worked or not. But it, but I use it as an example of the evidence for that we are adopting practices too early based upon preliminary, quote unquote, encouraging research, and that, that physicians unfortunately lack a proper understanding of how much evidence is necessary before we can conclude something probably works. I think that the impression is that if there's preliminary encouraging research, that something therefore probably works. But in reality, it probably doesn't work. It's the exact opposite. And that's what leads to this premature adoption of practices, which then when they get studied more definitively, a lot of them don't work. I think the numbers he previously came up with, like something like 45% of the individual practices ended up not being confirmed by later research. About a third were confirmed and like 20% were inconclusive. So yeah, that's, again, it just supports my science-based medicine approach in terms of, yeah, there's a lot of false positives. Most of the literature is wrong. It takes time to really know if something works or not, and we shouldn't jump on the bandwagon too early. Okay, let's go to number three. A new analysis finds that Bitcoin requires as much energy, 45.8 terawatt hours, as Kansas City. You all think this one is science, and this one is science. Good work, guys.
Oh, it is.
Thank you. Yay.
Yeah, Bitcoin uses ton of energy. They also said it, that's as much energy, it's more energy than Jordan. And a little bit less, somewhere between Jordan and Sri Lanka. So as much as a small country.
Yeah, I feel like I feel like I just didn't know how big Kansas City was.
Yeah, it's a big, it's a city. It's a big city. Think about it.
Missouri,
it's a lot
or
of energy. And I know there are,
I don't know,
there are concerns about the carbon footprint of Bitcoin. It uses up a lot of energy. If we actually moved entirely over to cryptocurrency, we wouldn't have enough energy, you know, to crunch all those.
Oh my God!
Those blockchains,
nuclear power plants.
Right, we'd have to build a ton of nuclear energy in order to run Bitcoin.
There's an impetus for you.
It is a major downside of cryptocurrency. Okay, and I'm sure we're going to get emails now from the cryptocurrency fans. This is the facts. These are the facts.
We're not making
the Winklevosses.
We have no skin in the game. We're trying to say what the truth is.
So, of course, all this means that a new study finds that having higher education levels has a protective effect against developing Alzheimer's disease. Right, Jay? Old-timer's disease?
Yeah, old-timer's.
This is the fiction. Carrie, you nailed it. So there is a well-known, and this is what you were remembering, Evan, there is a well-known benefit for having greater cognitive reserve for people who develop dementia. So the more mentally active you are, the more education, the smarter you are, the more cognitive reserve you have, and the more delayed is the impact of developing dementia.
There it is.
But, like, it staves it off longer.
Staves off the effects because you're starting from a higher point. So as you decline, you remain functional for longer. It just makes sense. But the question is there something about that? Is it recruiting new neural stem cells, or is it doing something and stimulating the brain that actually delays the pathology? So the study was looking at cognitive reserve and late life amyloid beta deposition. Amyloid beta is one of the pathological markers of Alzheimer's disease. And they found that it had no effect. So when you use the term Alzheimer's disease, you're talking about the pathology. If I had said dementia, that would have been ambiguous and that might have been correct. But if you say Alzheimer's disease, the pathology, nope. And we didn't think that it did, but now the evidence shows, no, it doesn't affect the pathology. It just gives you more reserve so that you're functional for longer. So it's still a good thing. It's like building up your muscles so that when you age and your muscles atrophy, you stay stronger longer because you had more muscles to begin with. Mm-hmm. Or building up your bone density so you develop less osteoporosis as you age. It doesn't change the process, but it just you have a higher starting point so you could coast longer into your old age. Okay. Good job, everyone.
All right.
Maybe someday we'll talk about the Alzheimer's vaccination. Ooh.
There's so much research with Alzheimer's. I mean, it's like solar and batteries. Every week there's something, but who knows what's going to actually pan out.
Yeah.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Science cannot long remain unfettered in a social system which seeks to exercise control over the whole spiritual and intellectual life of a nation. The correctness of a scientific theory can never be adjudged by its readiness to give the answers desired by political leadership. That was written by Charles A. Leone. He's the author of Lysenko versus Mendel.
Yeah, we talked about Lysenkoism with respect to Chernobyl. A very apropos quote, Evan.
Yeah, I think so.
I'm sure not by coincidence.
No, I think not.
Yeah.
It's a good discussion today.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's a core, and I use Lysenko all the time. It's like you cannot yoke scientific thinking to the current political winds. You just can't do it. Science does not work. Science it needs to be, I think, unfettered is the perfect word.
Definitely.
Yeah, it needs to just follow the evidence, follow the logic where it leads. It can't serve a political purpose.
Nope.
Yeah. The result is literal disaster.
I know, and we can all learn. And that this lesson never goes away. It's timeless.
Never.
It doesn't matter which generation we ascribe it to. It's always the case.
Hey, so guys, before we go, a quick announcement. So Nexus is coming up, as you know, July 11th to 14th in New York. We're all going to be there. We're going to have an SGU show. It's going to be wonderful. We're going to do an extravaganza. It might be the last extravaganza we do for the year.
Oh.
And our early bird registration has been extended. So I think when this show comes up, there'll be just a few days left for early bird registration. So if you want to get the cheaper rate, go to necss.org, register for Nexus. We'd love to see you there. Always a fun conference. We have a great lineup this year. Check it out. Great workshops.
Carl Zimmer, Mary Roach.
Paul Offit.
Paul Offit.
Right there. Yes. Come on.
Bob Novella.
Yeah. Bob's going to be there.
Yeah, it's going to be a good year. So we'd love to see you there. All right, guys. Thank you all for joining me.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible. And don't forget about KiwiCo. KiwiCo projects are designed to spark creativity, tinkering, and learning in kids of all ages. They make learning about science, technology, engineering, arts, and math fun. They're on a mission to empower kids, not just to make a project, but to make a difference. KiwiCo is offering the Skeptic's Guide listeners the chance to try them for free. To redeem this offer and learn more about their projects for kids of all ages, visit kiwico.com/skeptics.